Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everybody, welcome to episode 193 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. This week we're talking about great mid-engine performance cars, for good reason, because we had a display of great mid-engine performance cars at yesterday's Bicester Heritage Sunday Scramble. Now, before we get started, I will just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. It really helps. And of course, we want a good review and a good rating. And while you're doing it, just hit the little follow button or the subscribe button. It helps us, essentially, it helps us find new listeners. So please keep doing that and enjoy the episode. We had a fun day yesterday, Andrew. We're at Bicester Heritage for the latest Sunday Scramble.
We had amazingly, a cold day yesterday.
Very cold day. But they've still never had a wet one. This is, the 7th of January. In the UK, and actually it was cold, but it was a dry day. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't describe myself, frankly, in any way at all as a religious person. But if one were, or if one believed in some kind of divine being, you might think that he, she, or it had looked upon the Sunday Scramble as basically being a good thing to do. A good event,
an event
which basically everybody who's got anything to do with it benefits from. And so, yeah, it's almost as if some superior beings decided that is one particular parade it's not going to rain upon. And it never has. But it didn't mean it was. Yeah, you and I basically stood by the cars that we had there for 6 hours. Mm. And I got so cold. It's a kind of cold that you can't get rid of just by, you know, going somewhere warm. I sat in a car for 2 hours with the bum warmers on, the heater up full, all the way home. I still then had to go and sit in the hot bath for a bit before I kind of felt myself again. But, wow, it was worth it, wasn't it? What a great event. What a great day. And it was so gratifying to see the hundreds of people who came up to us to look at our cars, have a chat with us, being kind enough to tell us that they enjoy what we do. It was just a fantastic day out, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. So thanks for everyone who came and said hello. We do appreciate it. They are fantastic events, the Scrambles. The next ones in spring will be there. And of course, having spoken about there never being a wet one, we have now jinxed it. And the spring Scramble is going to be a washout, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So we were there with a lineup of five mid-engined cars.
Yes.
It was a great lineup, I thought. So just running through them in order, we had the Porsche 718 Spyder RS, a brand new car from Porsche, mid-engined, of course.
I mean, so many people said to me that's the first time that they'd seen it. They didn't know that they were over here or anything. It's, I think for many people it was the first opportunity to see one, certainly in the UK in right-hand drive.
Absolutely, yeah. And then as a bit of a contrast, we had a BMW M1 parked right next to it. I mean, what have they got in common? They're German mid-engine two-seaters. It's probably about it, isn't it?
Six cylinder engines, naturally aspirated, manual rear drive. Not an awful lot, but
no.
I mean, it's just great because it's one of the things that I love about TI is that we don't have to think, well, we're we're a modern car business or an old car business. You know, we're just a great car business, aren't we? We just love great cars whenever they came from, wherever they came from. And, you know, having, you know, we had an age span of, you know, of 40 years. And that was frankly only because we decided to restrict it to mid-engine cars. So, yeah, and that M1, wow. I mean, it's just come out of an enormous restoration. It's the first time it's been seen in public since. Gee, I mean, they're just fabulous things.
It's so pretty.
Yeah.
And the wheels, the Campagnolo wheels, are just so gorgeous. Yeah. And that was parked alongside an Aston Martin Valkyrie. Nothing if not a broad church here, even within the sort of one genre, mid-engine two-seaters. I mean, the variety in those three is pretty extraordinary. The Valk, though, it was our, I call it our flame, because the moths were just drawn to it all day long.
It was unbelievable. I mean, there were times, in fact, there were lots of times. I was sending the bloke at Aston Martin who helps us out, getting it. I was sending him pictures of just people, because I said, I'm trying to send you a picture of the car, but you can't actually see it, because there were just so many people. You know what I love most about it? Was the little kids. Because people, it's a great event for people to bring their kids to. And the number of, you know, I don't know, 7-year-olds who were just peering through. And it was me. It was me sitting on my backside at Maranello Concessionaires in 1973, looking at the first Ferrari Bernetta Boxster in the country. I found it quite moving, really, because to see them looking in the window of a Valkyrie. And I kind of knew exactly what was going through their minds. It's exactly what was going through my mind, bloody hell, you know, half a century ago. And it was fantastic. And as you say, I mean, we had some amazing cars there, but I mean, the Valkyrie was just, I mean, if when it left, because the event shut up at sort of just after 2 o'clock and it had to disappear back onto the truck in which it came. It was like the Pied Piper. I don't know if you saw it, but there were people video. Running after it. And if it had driven off a cliff, they'd have all followed.
It was great. It was great. And without Bicester and without Aston Martin's help there, all those kids and all those grown-up kids might never have seen an Aston Martin Valkyrie. And of course, there was another one just down the road. But it's cool, isn't it?
And let alone, I mean, extraordinary cars. They would have seen them on photographs. They've seen them on YouTube. They might have seen them on a stand somewhere. But to be able to literally, I mean, there are no barriers around it, literally get up and stick your nose against the window, which when you're 7 years old is what you want to do. Oh, that was great. It was great. Sorry, I'm digressing.
Well, and next to that, we had your McLaren Artura, your long-term.
In inverted commas, yeah.
Yes. But,
yes.
Which we have spoken about quite recently, haven't we? But it's, that is the first time I've seen it in person. It's a very pretty thing.
It is very pretty. What do you think of the colour? And,
I like the colour. I like the colour. It's not too punchy. It's a good, bold colour, but it's not a sort of blow your eyeballs orange.
They do four oranges, and it's the darkest. They call it Ember Orange. What do they call it? There's another orange they do. It's the traditional McLaren orange called papaya, isn't it? And it's not that. And I mean, to me, certainly as someone who doesn't necessarily want to draw an enormous amount of attention to themselves, all the better for it. Yeah, it was great. I sort of got in it at 5 in the morning because we had to have it there and clean on standby by 8. And I just sort of wafted out through the village in silence, didn't wake anybody up, got on the open road. Gave it hell. It was great.
You seem to be enjoying it. And that was next to our the third co-founder of the Intercooler, who you don't hear about very often, but he brought one of his cars along. Very special car. One of only, he thinks, 4 or 5 in the country.
Yeah.
A Honda NSX-R.
Many. Yeah.
Yeah. Honda NSX-R, a first-gen one with the pop-up headlamps, which got about as much attention as anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so... it's such a discreet car, given how, frankly, different it is to a standard NSX. I mean, you know, I think most people saw it and just thought, oh, that's a nice NSX. And it's only if you start sort of, that was on non-OEM wheels, because NSX-R wheels are very rare and precious. And, I mean, the owner does have them, but hasn't got them on the car.
I think there are issues with tyre sizes as well, aren't there?
Yeah, I think there are. I think there are, just getting rather for it. Unless you looked at the NSX badge and saw a little hyphen R, you wouldn't know that this was a, you know, the lightweight, very rare, very special. I can remember driving one of those at a test track, I think called Tochigi in Japan.
Yeah.
It was one of those vast tracks they have, which they basically have two straights and a couple of banked corners at the end of it. And the, I think the mistake they made was that They had a speed trap at the end of the straight and a big sign flashed up telling you how fast you're going. As you came, no, it wasn't at the end of the straight. It was at the end of the banking, telling you how fast you're coming off the banking. And I was coming off the banking at 170 something, and eventually they got me in and told me to stop doing that. But I mean, come on, tell me.
Well, they're about, asking for it.
Putting temptation in my way. You're going to put a bloody great speed sign up there and a load of journalists. Of course, you don't want to be the journalist who comes away with the second highest speed. So anyway, what a great car. What a great event. What a great lineup.
Yeah. So we five really cool cars, I thought. And I mean, it's inspired the theme for this week's podcast, hasn't it? We're going to discuss the greatest mid-engine cars from the great car-producing nations. And it occurred to me that at least one of those is probably an example of exactly that, the greatest mid-engine car from that country. We'll come to it. Now, I just want to clarify a little bit. We talk about the great car-producing nations, and we all sort of have a sense of what that means. But, I mean, if we're going to be objective about it for just a moment, I've got a list of the biggest car-producing countries here, right? Strictly the biggest. And it goes China, US, Japan, India, South Korea, Germany, Mexico, Brazil, right? That's not what we're talking about, are we? We're not talking about India and South Korea and the rest of it because, well, obvious reasons. So instead, we're talking...
Not a great proliferation of indigenous mid-engine cars for those countries.
No. So we're talking traditionally the producers of great performance cars. We all know what they are. So let's not get derailed too much by that point. But before we get started, we do just sort of need to discuss mid-engine cars generally and what we mean by mid-engine cars, because we could be pedantic about this if we wanted to. And I also want to talk about the sort of advantages of the mid-engine configuration. First of all, what do we mean by mid-engine? Because you can put the engine right behind the front axle line in a car, but in front of the cabin and call it mid-engined.
Which it kind of is. I mean,
VTOL, Ferraris.
I think technically speaking, a mid-engine car, well, I mean, it's a fairly loose term, isn't it? But it's any car whose engine exists entirely within the wheelbase of the car. But that's not what we're talking about now. What we're talking about now is engines that are entirely within the wheelbase of the car, but at the same time behind the driver.
And that's what people think of, really.
That's what people, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Why mid-engine? Why put the engine there? What's the advantage? Are there any drawbacks?
Well, I mean, mid-engine cars, I mean, they've actually been, you know, in racing, they've been around forever. I mean, you know, the auto unions of the 1930s were mid-engine cars. And yet they kind of forgot about it. And then they started popping back into Formula One in the late 1950s. I mean, you know, they were racing, you know, all those amazing little 500cc things that guys like Stirling Moss made his name in what was then Formula Three in the late 40s and early 50s. They were all mid-engine. What are the advantages? I mean, well, I mean, people talk about low polar moments of inertia. But basically, if you concentrate all the masses in the center of a car, it's going to be more agile. And I think if you think about, if you had a sort of, I don't know, a length of broom handle and you had two weights on either end and you threw it, it would be quite cumbersome. But if you put those weights in the middle, the effect of having that mass in one place right in the middle is lessened. So it becomes more agile. At the same time, you know, there's always, isn't there, that trade-off between agility and stability. And therefore you get one of the sort of traditional alleged disadvantages of mid-engine cars, which is that they can be tricky on the limit, and some of them are. I would say, generally speaking, mid-engine cars, although much tamed these days, are trickier on the limit for exactly those reasons. They allow a much smaller frontal area. It means you have much less weight on the nose. I mean, you know, in terms of pure speed, mid-engine cars transform the face of racing. You know, the moment that Cooper started winning world championships with mid-engine cars, I mean, the first one they won was in 1959, the next one in 1960, and then Ferrari, very, as ever, late to the party, thought, oh, we better do one, and every single Formula One world championship has been won by a mid-engine car ever since. I mean, it's one of those completely transformational technologies that comes along once in a while. And actually, I think a lot of it is that. I think a lot of the reason cars are mid-engine today are, you know, partly for sound engineering reasons, but partly I think it's because that's what Formula One cars are like. And I think partly it's a sort of marketing thing. And I think there is a kind of like a cool kudos that comes from having the same powertrain configuration as, you know, as the world's fastest racing cars. So I think there's a lot of that in it. I mean, disadvantages, I mean, packaging. It's very difficult, not impossible. I mean, it has been done, but it's very difficult to create a car which will seat four people and an engine within the wheelbase. You know, you either have a very, very cramped rear or a very, very long wheelbase, usually both. It kind of means you kind of split your luggage. So, you know, if you're lucky, there's a bit in the front, a bit in the back. It's not very practical. Getting at it, maintenance is obviously more difficult. I mean, there are reasons not not to do it. But if what you are looking for is, you know, dynamic response, and I guess looking cool, because mid-engine cars do look quite cool because they don't need to have, you know, big noses and radiators and that sort of thing up there, then, yeah, they have been for many, many years the way forward.
Got a quick tangent. Why did it take Grand Prix cars so long to put the engine in the middle? Because, as you say, it had been done by the auto unions before the war.
Yeah, which were Grand Prix cars. Yeah, I don't know. It's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, so let's say it was done by auto union before the war. And then the war came along, and let's give them, you know, a sort of 10-year period from 39 to 49. You know, we give that over to, you know, sorting themselves out after. But it still took another 10 years, didn't it?
Mm. But as you said, it was being done in the smaller categories.
Yeah. It's... I don't know. You know, someone like David Tuig would know. Maybe Karun would know. But it just seems bizarre. I mean, maybe... you had, you know, a lot of manufacturers in that time were using proprietary parts, and maybe they didn't fit, or maybe the engineering of it was considered to be too difficult. But I don't have a good answer to that question, I'm afraid, and I should, but I don't. But certainly, the moment someone, and maybe it was just the fact that nobody was doing it, so nobody felt the need to do it. But that's stupid, because it's Formula One. Because if you thought there was an advantage, you'd take it, wouldn't you? I don't know. Sorry.
Strange, isn't it? Really strange. But okay, let's get on to the individual nations then. And it would be great to be decisive about this and try and come away with one car for each of the countries that we're going to discuss. Some of them, it's actually quite difficult to draw up a shortlist because there just aren't that many. Others, the shortlist could be not a shortlist at all. It could be a long list. So let's get started with Japan, right? And okay. I want to start with Japan because I suspect the car that we had on display yesterday, I mean, it's certainly on the shortlist, but it might even be the winner, mightn't it? The Honda NSXR?
Of Japan? Japan's best mid-engine car?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's that, or it's the original MR2.
Those are the two I've got as well.
Yeah, I mean, the original MR2, I mean, I can remember driving those in the late 80s. And what was so clever, and actually the second generation car threw this out the window, what was so clever about those original MR2s is they handled beautifully. Mm. You know, this was back in the era when, you know, mid-engine car, you look at the Ferraris that were coming out at the time, things like 308s and 328s and Boxers and Testarossa, these are tricky cars, really tricky. I mean, cars that you drove within their limits, because once they started to go, they tended to stay gone. Mm. And along came this little Toyota, which you could just hoof about all over the place. It was just terrific. It was so reassuring and so nimble and agile and fun, but not scary. And then the second one came along and, you know, decided that it was just going to go back to being what mid-engine cars have traditionally been, which is a really difficult to drive. And I never understood why. So, I mean, I think, yeah, the NSXR probably is the one, but with a massively honourable mention to the original MR2, which was, you know, it was the car that showed us, because even the things that, you know, affordable mid-engine cars that have come before, and there weren't many, I'm thinking Fiat X19, and I'm now starting to struggle, even those were only fun up to a point. So, yeah. I think the MR2 is an absolutely fantastic candidate.
So, okay, but I think we're going to declare the NSX-R the champion for Japan here. I have driven one. I drove the one that we had on the stand yesterday, a few years ago. Yeah. It is a gorgeous thing. It is a gorgeous thing. Once you're up and running on the road, steering's unassisted, isn't it? So it's hard work at low speed. But once you're moving, it's so detailed.
Have you ever driven an NSX with power-assisted steering?
No.
It was one of the very first E-Pass systems, which they had on the automatic cars, because Honda basically, when they made the automatic NSX, they decided that they were going to ruin it. So they detuned the engine, fitted the world's worst automatic gearbox, softened it off, and put electric power steering on it. And if you ever want to drive a car which is just absolutely not as its makers intended it to be, drive an automatic NSX. Sorry, I've digressed again.
We're supposed to be talking about good mid-engine cars.
Yeah, good mid-engine car. So the NSX-R, or if you want something slightly less eclectic, a late 3.2 NSX, one with the sort of bubble headlights. They were fabulous things. Mm. I mean, just...
I suspect you're getting most of the charm and the fun of an R in a good standard one, aren't you?
But it's always the way, isn't it, with those things? You know, if you drive a G-Series 911 and then you drive a Club Sport, I mean, a Club Sport is better in every way, but it's not transformational. It's not absolutely night and day. And I think it's the same sort of thing. I presume you didn't think very hard about having the, I was about to say current NSX, but it's not current anymore because they canned it, but the sort of the more recent NSX.
No.
Doesn't even get on the score sheet, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, it's phenomenally fast, that car. I remember thinking it is outrageously quick down the road. It's
nothing for me at all. I mean, really, given where it came from, given the level of expectation, given the name that it had, it's right up there with among the most disappointing cars I've ever driven. And I never understood why anybody was some people raved about it. Some people went, oh, well, yeah, it's really pretty good. Oh, I just thought, you know, if you think about what McLaren and Porsche, and Ferrari particularly were producing, I mean, it just didn't get anywhere near.
And you think about, it's got the same badge as the NSX-R, NSX. They're both NSXs, but they're totally diametrically opposed in terms of how you go about driving them. So the modern one, you're such a small component in making it go quickly, such a small component. In the older car, it's the exact opposite. I remember driving that older car, and, well, first of all, the visibility is outrageously good. I remember thinking, I'm watching the stones in the road, individual stones in the road, rush underneath the front tires. That's the sense you get. So you position it with confidence. The steering is so sweet, so connected. Mm-hmm. Great manual gear shift. That V6 is a honey as well. It's just so much fun to drive. Properly involving.
Yeah. I mean, they could get big on you. Although he's not in the business anymore, but I can remember standing at the edge of a corner. When we do cornering slots, I'm not saying this to you because you know this, but for the benefit of the audience, we, particularly if the corner isn't completely clear, we have spotters. So one person does the skid through the corner and another person is standing there on a radio saying, coast is clear, you can cut. And I can remember standing there on a corner watching one of my more junior road testers trying to hoof this NSX through a corner. And the car ended up some distance into a field. Far enough to have to go and get a farmer and a tractor. I mean, amazing. Yeah. It came out and we sort of, you know, washed the mud off and carried on what we're doing. Didn't have a mark on it. But they could get
I'm sure
quite interesting to drive. But yeah, fantastic. I don't think the NSX-R was like that, actually. I think there's another reason for that to be number one. But anyway, yes, we should probably move on.
There we go.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We should move on. So that's Japan. And I mean, I want to come to the more obvious countries towards the end of the episode. So let's do a couple of less obvious ones, or the ones that don't have so many candidates. And it's funny, isn't it? The one that really leaps to mind is the United States.
Yes.
Long, long history of producing great performance cars. Not that many with the engine in the middle.
Very few.
It's not what they do, is it, really?
No. Pontiac Fiero has come to me. I mean, there have been. I don't think that's going to get too close to the list. Someone's going to come on here and tell me that Pontiac Fiero is not mid-engine. I think it is. Anyway, so what are you thinking?
Well, it's only in the last couple of years that Corvette qualifies with the C8, the latest one. The engine's in the middle now. You've driven at least one.
I've only driven one. The Z06 with the Z07 upgrade. Bloody hell! Mm. That is something. That is one proper weapon. Yeah. I mean, I was... Sometimes you sort of... And this probably says something about me. You go up, you know you're going to go and drive a car and you think, oh, this is going to be interesting, this is going to be fun. But you don't think about it that seriously. Maybe you don't think about the numbers. And there's something slightly patronizing going on, because I'm thinking in my head, well, it's a vet, it's that. You know, this isn't going to blow my mind because, you know, they don't. But it did. Mm. I mean, fully Z07'd up. It was too much for the public road. I mean, it just screamed. I mean, this is kind of like it's almost like their answer. In fact, probably is their answer to the GT3 RS. It's that level of focus.
Wow.
Where you just drive, you just drive it and you just think, well, cool, but I just wish I was on the sort of Silverstone Grand Prix circuit, not some Welsh mountain road. But unbelievably credible. Yeah. If that car doesn't sell, it's because, well, in Europe, it's because people are snobby about the badge. It's got nothing about, it says nothing about the car's ability, because it was mega.
It must be good value for money, even once it's over here. And
Yeah, it is. I can't remember what it costs. But yeah, compared to what you spend on a McLaren or a Ferrari. I suspect even a GT3 RS. Great value for money. Odd looking thing.
I think it's dog's dinner. It's a mess.
Yeah.
I think it's a mess.
I can remember seeing one in, I think probably the first one I saw was in America somewhere. It's parked at the side of the street. I just couldn't believe how bad it looked. It's just so
messy.
It's like every bit of it was designed by one person without reference to any of the other people who designed the rest of the car. And so many fins and slats and straights and spats on it and just stuff on it. And it just looks a mess, doesn't it?
And then when you add the Z07 package or whatever it is that adds all the aero bits, it's even worse.
Yeah. But you know, don't for a moment think that in any way disqualifies that car from this conversation. Because this isn't a beauty pageant. This is about the best driving mid-engine cars. And I think it's right up there. But it wouldn't get my vote, even among the Americans.
So what else is there? There's not a lot. I can only think of two generations of Ford GT.
Yeah, so the first generation of Ford GT. That was brilliant. Second generation car, impressive, proper homologation special. Liked it for that, but...
V6 twin turbo, that's the one we're talking about, isn't it? Pedal shift.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I wouldn't have that over, you know, a far cheaper, quicker, more entertaining, easier McLaren 720S or a 488 or an F8 or a Pista or any equivalent Ferrari or McLaren. But the first generation one, my goodness, that was...
I've never been anywhere near one.
Brilliant. I think one of the... We still titter about this to this day. 20 years, it must have been 20 years ago, a very young Jethro Boddington and I headed off down Highway 1 in Los Angeles in one of those with a 360 Modena, which I can't remember where we got that from. It might even have been a Ford. It might have been one of those cars that Ford had for benchmarking purposes, and maybe we nicked it from them. I can't remember where we did, but anyway, we got up. It was a Sunday morning. We got up at daybreak and basically had the West Coast to ourselves. and just spent a few hours driving like, well, the way that you can or certainly could back then. And the Ford absolutely wiped the floor with the Ferrari.
Wow.
Absolutely. I can think the only thing I can think of now, which it didn't do as well, it didn't sound as nice because they were quite this. Because you think, you know, supercharged V8, it's going to sound absolutely unbelievable. And it just didn't. It just sounded a bit bleh. But other than that, I mean, it drove away from the Ferrari. It was far easier to drive than the Ferrari. It was a nicer place to be. It was better. I mean, just in every area, this upstart Ford of a kind that they hadn't made for decades. Are we going to allow the original GT40 into this? I mean, well, the road car version was utter rubbish. So the Mark III GT40 of the 1960s. So that was a terrible car. And although the race cars were technically road legal, I think they're not part of this conversation myself. So Ford had no prior in designing this car, and straight out the box they produced something which was streets ahead of, you know, the best Ferrari could do in that category at the time.
Well, that has to be it then, doesn't it? It looks fantastic, Ford GT. Cool cabin. Yeah, so there we go. Ford GT is the best mid-engine car from the United States. Crystal clear. Okay, so we're going back across the Atlantic. We're in France now.
France?
Yeah, I've got... I mean, it's obvious for me. It's obvious for me.
T16-205?
No, I mean, good shout, but no.
Okay, are we allowed those?
you can nominate if you want. No, neither have I, so... It would be a leap for us to declare the best.
I can see the inevitability of the phrase Alpine A110 heading in the direction of this conversation.
There it is. But, okay, well, let's park that for a moment, because what else is there? Renault Sport Spider? I mean, it wasn't brilliant, was it?
No, it wasn't very good at all. I have a very, very soft spot for an A610.
Yeah.
Do you remember there were those three original sort of Alpines? There was the original A110, which also I have an incredibly soft spot for. The A310, which I don't at all. Only drove one, didn't like it at all. But the A610 was a great car. With that sort of twin turbo V6. Amazing looks, great to drive. You know, there's a bit of me which would really like one of those. I think if you drove one along with, I'm just trying to think what contemporary 911 would it? Would it be a 964 or a 993?
Don't know.
I think it would have been a 993 maybe. You'd be amazed at how close it got. And it was killed by snobbery. People just didn't want to spend. Oh, the MVS Venturi. Do you even know what I'm talking about?
Oh my God. No.
Does it ring a bell?
Venturi.
Yeah.
Maybe so I think it's something else.
There was a French manufacturer around that time, which produced a mid-engine car called the Venturi, which was good. It was, I mean, it wasn't great, but it was good. I enjoyed it.
What else is there then?
Oh, T16, not much.
What about Venturi Atlantique? Do you remember that?
No.
1999, no. Very pretty thing. I mean, they must have built about four.
Well, if they did, I never drove one.
No. Oh, I mean, it looks gorgeous. Oh, 1991, so through the 90s it was in production. Don't know.
Yeah, anyway, so are we talking about the same thing?
What did you say?
MVS Venturi. I mean, it's possible, of course, that I'm having a...
Oh, it's the same thing. Yeah, same thing.
It is the same thing. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought I might be having a massively senior moment. surprisingly good.
Great.
Very credible car. Yeah, no, it is. It's a great looking car, and it really wasn't bad to drive at all. I think we did a...
glowing.
I think we did a triple test with that and the A610 and whatever 911 it would have been. So maybe it was a 964. And I think it probably did come third, but it wasn't one of those "what on earth is this car doing here" kind of tests, which sometimes you do. Yeah. It was good.
But it's the modern A110, isn't it?
Oh, for the purposes of this,
yeah,
I just thought I'd string you along a bit.
Well, let's not dwell on it, because.
And what about? Okay, I was really looking forward to seeing your face here. I was thinking I'd be doing this on video. The René Bonnet de Jet.
Yeah, Jet, yeah. Well, some people call that the first mid-engine car, don't they?
Exactly.
Road car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you driven one? Has anyone driven one? No.
I don't know. Anybody listening to this podcast, have you driven one? Can we sort of turn things around? You tell us what it was like to drive for once. I'm not a driver, but I must have seen one in some museum somewhere. But the first mid-engine, everybody goes, oh yeah, Lamborghini Miura, first mid-engine road car. Wasn't. I think the Tommaso Mangusta beat the Miura as well. Like all these things, isn't it? Whatever car, and I would say almost without exception, is generally credited with being the first to do something. Almost without exception, it isn't. And certainly the Miura was not the first mid-engine road car, but I've never driven a René Bonnet Jet. So I can't comment any further. It's the A110.
Okay, good. Let's not dwell on that. So we're going to move across the border now, and we're getting serious now, right? We're in Germany. This is where we've got a good number of candidates to discuss. Let's be honest, most of them have a Porsche. Not as many as you might think. Most of them have a Porsche badge on the nose. But there are a couple of others. So let's do the less obvious ones. I mean, Audi R8, particularly the original, has to be in contention. Oh, that's so good
to drive. Original manual R8 original manual V8 R8. It's going to be right up there. Yeah.
Imagine having one of those for a couple of months and getting rid of it. Who'd do that?
Who'd do that? Sorry, we mustn't do injects on this. Really mustn't. We do know someone who had a beautiful, lovely manual V8 R8 and doesn't anymore.
Anyway, but they're fantastic to drive, aren't they? The engines are really sweet. They steer, they ride, they're balanced. The gear shift is wonderful. They look cool. Yeah. Brilliant. I'd love one. I'd love one. Okay, from R8 to i8, though, BMW. I mean, we know you love the BMW i8. But does it really qualify in this competition? Great driver's car?
That's not what you said. That's not what you said. You said mid-engine car. Okay. Is it a great car? Is it mid-engine? Yes and yes.
Okay, fine.
I mean, okay, if it was a... I don't know. You would make a mid-engine limousine, but I mean, it qualifies because it's. I reckon it's going to be the only car that we talk about today that's got rear seats. I don't imagine we're talking about the Ferrari 308 GT4 very much. And I think it is a genius piece of engineering, so far ahead of its time. I mean, think like the i3. I think the only crime the i3 and the i8 ever committed was to be 10 years ahead of their time. And I think if they launched a car like that now with modern technology, given the way the world is going, everybody is suddenly realizing that, you know, what you need at the moment before EVs are fully established and infrastructure up is you need a car with that sort of powertrain. Where you have a blend of hybrid and electrical power. But what BMW also managed to do was to make it sound great, was to keep it light, put it in a practical package, make it utterly gorgeous. Not great, but really, really good to drive. I think it's a landmark car, and I think it is such a shame. They're cheap now as well. I say cheap.
They're getting there, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, 40 grand, you'll get a very nice one for £40,000. I can't see that if you bought an i840, because you don't hear stories about them. You don't hear people. You know, it's not like, you know, E60 M5s. You know, you never hear, oh, yeah, we don't go anywhere near the i8 because this happens. The wheels fall off or the engine blows. You just don't hear stories about them. And I think
wonder about the battery in particular in the hybrid system. Yeah. Might that be problematic 10 years down the road? Could be.
I don't know. Might be. Don't know. Anyway, yeah, great car. What else?
Okay. So there are several Porsches, aren't there? Sort of more ordinary ones, ordinary being a relative to... Well, actually, no, but let's talk about like a fairly basic Porsche Cayman S, six-cylinder one.
Gorgeous cars. I mean, brilliant cars. I mean, cars that are so good. You know, Porsche had to kind of... When those cars first came out, Porsche had to do things like not fit limited slip differentials to them to make sure they weren't quicker than 911s. They were... terrific things. Yeah, what can I say? I mean, a 4-litre Cayman GTS is, you know, one of the cars that I would really, really love to, you know, to have as my all-day, every-day, do-everything kind of car. You know, the only people who will never tell you that these cars are, you know, not quite a 911 or a Paul Mount 911 are people who've driven them, people who own them. They absolutely love them. They are so good to drive. Something like a Cayman R, I think, is just a fantastic choice of car. I mean, GT4s are wonderful. Of course they are. But you don't need to do that to, you know, to have a wonderful driving experience. I think, well, frankly, any six cylinder Cayman is a terrific car.
But let's talk about the big stuff. And we need to get through to a couple of fairly mighty countries. So let's get through Germany now. But we need to talk about the Porsche Carrera GT and I think the Porsche 918 Spyder as well. How clearly one succeeded the other. How do they compare?
I mean, they're just so different. One is a, you know, is a stillborn racing car with an extraordinary V10 engine in it. The other is an amazing technological showpiece. I mean, incredibly impressive. I'd have the Carrera GT. I drove one for the first time really quite recently, about 20 years late to the party as ever. But I just loved it. I just loved the tactility of it, the pureness of it. And I guess the difference is that I massively admire a 918 Spyder, I love a Carrera GT. Or the sort of the Holy Trinity that people used to talk about, the 918, the LaFerrari and the McLaren P1. If I'd done that triple test, I think it probably would have come third. So for me, it's Carrera GT.
Yeah, I've only driven a Carrera GT briefly, but it's just such an intoxicating thing. And that engine is unbelievable. Are we declaring the Carrera GT the greatest German mid-engine car?
I guess so. What's a Bugatti? Is it French? Is it Italian? Is it German?
Well, they've got to be count as French, haven't they?
Well, Bugatti was an Italian, but he built his cars in France, and the company's now owned by the Germans.
But it's, come on. We've already got a winner from France. Okay, Carrera GT wins for Germany. We're moving across to Italy now, and I am 99.999 recurring percent sure I know what the winner is here.
Do you?
Yes.
Out of all, I don't.
Oh, come on. Yes, you do.
I know. I enlighten me.
Surely you're going to say F40.
Oh. Yes. I have just had a senior moment, haven't I? Yeah, I am going to say F40. Well, of course I'm going to say F40 because it's the greatest car that's ever been built. Yes, it's the F40. Yes.
Okay.
For some reason, I was suddenly in modern car mode, and I was thinking about, I think because I talked about sort of F8s and 296s and stuff. Yes, of course it's the F40. But yeah, that's the end of that conversation. Well, let's not be completely flip about it. But yes, it is. It's the most, it's still the greatest road car I've ever driven.
But what else gets a look in then? F50? Is that in the conversation? I've never driven one.
F50's in the conversation. It's a wonderful car. Absolutely beautiful. So sweet. Amazing. LaFerrari's in the conversation. There was a time briefly, once I first drove the LaFerrari, that I just thought, actually, I prefer this to an F40. I've kind of rolled back a bit from that now, but it's absolutely up there. But also, you know, okay, so I think that there are some other Ferrari. I mean, 246, you know, their first mid-engine car, the Dino. Mm. Oh, God. I mean, okay, I have a particular personal connection to the 246 because my father owned one for about 10 minutes once. And I think it did a lot to sort of switch me onto cars. But I think a 246, because again, unlike some of the later mid-engine Ferraris came along, they're so sweet. They're so lovely. You can drive them with such freedom because you're not scared of them. And I absolutely love those. You know, otherwise, I mean, just, you know, I think a 488 GTB is a great car. I think a standard 458 is a great car. I think something like a 360, we were at Bicester yesterday, and a 360 Talon Stradale rumbled past. And I remember thinking when I only drove one of those once, but I did. I went up to the north of England back in it, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, what an embarrassment of riches just to the Ferraris. And we haven't even mentioned Lamborghini yet.
Yeah, or Paganis, and then there's some more obscure stuff as well, particularly from the
Maserati. You know, Maserati Bora is a fantastic mid-engine car. But I mean, well, let's not be shy about this. They're not going to get on the scale. You know, they're not going to challenge the F40 or indeed the F50. Yeah, okay. That's the one.
F40 it is then. So we're coming home. Yeah. We're coming home, and again, I'm pretty sure I know what the answer is going to be here.
Hang on, we haven't done Sweden yet.
Well, what do you want to nominate from Sweden?
I've only done Koenigsegg. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Okay. actually, do you know
what? Fairly short conversation.
Someone told me yesterday about your first and only acquaintance with a Koenigsegg, and they said exactly that. You didn't like it very much.
No, I didn't. But well, it was a long time ago. If anybody would like to shoehorn me into a more modern Koenigsegg, I mean, I think it was one of the very first Koenigsegg, and it was just I happened to drive it on the same day I drove the only Pagani I've ever driven, and I thought the Pagani was wonderful, beautifully engineered, and a work of art. And I thought the Koenigsegg was just it was a really, really frightening car, and I don't like being frightened by cars.
God no. Okay, so we're coming home, UK. What are we talking then? Neither of us has yet driven an Aston Martin Valkyrie, have we? We had one there yesterday, but we've not actually driven one. So I think we need to scratch that one out.
So much choice. If you just look at Lotuses and McLarens, I mean, you know, there's an entire podcast there, isn't there?
Oh yeah.
So much choice. I think the most benign in terms of what you could do with it, mid-engine car I've ever driven, it's nowhere near this conversation. But just to point out its existence, everybody will have forgotten about it. Panther Solo. First four-wheel drive mid-engine car.
Yes.
I can remember driving one of those at Castle Coombe. I mean, it was a terrible car in many ways, but my goodness. I mean, it was almost unspinnable. It was extraordinary what you could do. You could just, you know, you just turn to a corner, lift off, wait until it was some ridiculous angle, then hit the gas again, and off you went. It was, anyway, so, what's it going to be? What's it going to be?
Jaguar XJ220?
It's not up there among the, for me, among the absolute, you know, when you think it's up against, you know, all those McLarens from, you know, the F1 to the present day, all those Lotuses, you know, when you think it's up against, you know, Elises and Espris and, I mean, an amazing statement car. Staggering in certain ways, but no, it's not up there. Jaguar XJR15, no, that's not going to get on the list either.
Okay. What are the Lotuses? I've got only because I drove one last year. Series 1 Elise. I mean, that has to be in the conversation.
Series 1 Elise in the conversation. There has to be an Esprit in the conversation because, and I guess you'd have a GT3 or a Sport 300 or actually just an S4S. I mean, you know, flawed in many ways, but so good to drive. So I think it's probably between them.
What about the modern McLarens though? Which is the one? If we can only nominate one of the modern McLarens, is it 675LT?
It's 675LT or it's a 720S. And we know someone who had one and now is the other. I think for me it's the 720S because it's you can just do. I mean, this old mantra of mine about, you know, the amount of fun you can have on a car is how enjoyable it is to drive multiplied by the number of times you feel inclined to use it. And that, to me, is what the 720S just does so incredibly well. It is such a usable car and so absurdly, ridiculously cut past. A 750S, I guess, is a bit more of the same. But, I mean, I'd say 720S, but I wouldn't argue too much with anybody who thought it was a 675LT.
Yeah, I'd go LT, but I take your point. But this is all just preamble, isn't it? Because we're labouring towards an inevitable conclusion, surely.
What, an F1?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, certainly in terms of importance, legacy, influence. I mean, one of the most astonishing pieces of road car engineering there's ever been. You know, I've said many, many times on this podcast and elsewhere that no car in history expanded the envelope of road car performance more than that car did. So I guess so. But again, not the easiest of cars.
No.
You know, some people have got into a whole world of pain in F1s. But yeah, I think so. And I'd like to shout out for the P1 too, because I think in 2013, the P1, given that they'd never done any kind of hybrid at all, I think the P1 was an extraordinary piece of work.
Mm.
And I still think when you look at the P1 today, I think probably of all the McLarens, when you look at the P1, is the one which makes you go, wow. I think it still looks absolutely ridiculous and brilliant for
it. It does. Are we declaring the F1, though, the greatest British mid-engine car?
Yeah, I think we are.
Okay, so there we go. Britain, McLaren F1, Japan, Honda NSXR, Germany, Porsche Carrera GT, Italy, Ferrari F40, US, Ford GT, the first one, France, Alpine A110, the modern one. Those are the best mid-engine cars from traditionally the big car-producing nations. There we go.
And the best, the winner is...
Oh, no, we can't do that. Come on, that's... don't know. I'm not even going to ask.
Let's not do that.
It's obviously the Alpine A110, isn't it?
Of course. Have you sort of paused for a moment to think of all the cars we haven't mentioned that we've forgotten, which people are going to contact and say, oh, yeah, but what about... And we're going to be thinking, oh, my God, how could we have forgotten that?
Yeah, there'll be loads.
So apologies in advance. There'll be entire countries that we've forgotten.
Yeah, there will. There will. Okay, well, I do have a listener question, but I'm going to save it for next week because it's been a busy show. But thank you, everyone, for listening. And please remember to just hit the little follow button or the subscribe button wherever you're watching this. It really helps us. And please come back for another episode of the Intercooler Podcast next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.